This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. If you've been paying attention to the conversation around climate change, you may have heard of a little place called the Larsen C Ice Shelf. It's a thick sheet of ice stuck to the coast of Antarctica. And until recently, it was cracking, threatening to spill an iceberg the size of Delaware into the sea. And now it has finally happened. And that iceberg, it's a big one. It weighs more than a trillion metric tons, one of the largest on record. Here to explain the implications for climate change, plus other short subjects in science, is Nick Stockton, science reporter for Wired in San Francisco. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hello, sir. How are you?
Nice to have you back. Yeah, I know. I was worried about the Larsen C Shelf, an iceberg the size of Delaware. Should we be afraid that Antarctica is coming apart?
Potentially. This calving iceberg itself, or this iceberg that's calved itself, is not going to be too much problem. It is a naturally occurring process. So scientists aren't actually linking this calving to climate change. This ice shelf was connected to the continental ice, but it was already floating, and it broke off to the accumulation of snow and ice. And so what they're mostly worried about is that this might cause the rest of the ice sheet to break up, the Larsen C ice shelf, to break apart. And that would be the big problem, because that would free up continental ice from Antarctica to also flow off into the ocean and melt.
Mm-hmm. How much could this contribute to sea level rise, all this ice floating out there?
Well, this particular iceberg, pretty negligible. Even though it's gigantic, as you mentioned, about the size of Delaware, it was already floating. So any volume it was going to add to the ocean was mostly already there. The rest of the ice breaking up, same story. It's already floating, but the stuff behind it, the stuff on the western side of Antarctica, the worst case scenario of that melting would add about 13 feet of sea level rise. But that would take about several centuries for all that to melt and add to the volume.
Mm-hmm. So they're saying we don't know if this one is connected to global warming, but we can't rule it out.
We can't rule it out, and what we do know is that the formation of a new ice shelf would be connected to global warming, because of course warmer temperatures make it harder for ice to accumulate.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's move up next to Elon Musk's plan to save Australia with batteries.
Right. Yeah. Elon Musk. So Australia. People have been paying attention to Australia, but Australia kind of put itself into a bind energy wise. It had relied on natural gas to provide electricity, but had exported too much natural gas, because that's a hot commodity. And when their hot summers came along, which is last winter for us, but winter summertime for them, the air conditioning of everybody trying to keep cool for those 100 degree plus days, put them into a deficit, and they had to do rolling brownouts. Mm-hmm. To keep the power on. So Elon Musk caught wind of that, tweeted out that you could solve their energy crisis in 100 days or less with a gigantic battery, or else it's free.
Hmm. So he's going to build a giant battery there?
Right. So this week, him and the Australian government finally signed a contract. They had to get over some kind of bureaucratic MacGuffins there. And now he has about 100 days to build this battery.
How big does it have to be?
Well, he promised it to be more than 100 megawatts, which is pretty big. A contributor at Wired actually estimated how much energy that would produce, and he calculating what you could do with energy, he could lift an aircraft carrier several hundred feet out of the ocean with a battery this size.
Hmm. And so how hard is it for him to make a battery that big?
Well, that's proprietary secret. But what we do know from the outside is that linking together all these lithium ion cores together is pretty dangerous. Everybody remembers from the hoverboard incidents, is putting lithium ion batteries too close together or wiring them together imperfectly can start a fire or an explosion. So that's kind of the engineering challenge here.
Yeah, we'll be talking a little bit later about new battery technology, but I want to move on to this next one, because this one really dazzled me a bit. We have been following this story for years. It involves a photon, a satellite, and some quantum physics, an entangled particle. Describe what they did there.
Yeah, so this came out of China, and China's been working really hard on quantum entanglement. And what that means is you take quantum particles, in this case photons, which are light particles, and tie them together using, quantum mechanics, and so that their states are, if one particle changes its state, it affects the other particles' state as well. And in this case, what they're doing is you actually monitor the state. And so as anybody who's familiar with, you know, Schrodinger's cat knows that if you monitor, if you try to measure the state of a particle, it automatically changes the state of that particle. And in the case of quantum entanglement, it'll change the state of any particle that's entangled to it. So what the Chinese scientists did is they sent a couple photons up on a satellite, and then they had the satellite emit these photons across a big area, and then they measured the state of these photons. And as they measured the state of the photons, they saw that the other photons that they were entangled to were able to change. And so again, the big breakthrough with this was the emitting of the photons right from the satellite. This was over 750 miles they were emitted, and photons over that distance have a tendency to break down. So this is a pretty big breakthrough.
And some of the headlines were saying erroneously that they had teleported an object into space, right? That's really not what they did.
No, not even at all. This is quantum states. This is information only.
Yeah, it's tough to get your head around it. And so they entangled these particles, sent their fellow sisters into space, and then found out that it works 700, you know, so many miles away. They have done this on the Earth, but this is the first time in space. Lastly, a cool new view of Jupiter. This is really cool. Tell us about that, please.
Yes. Yeah, so Juno is a spacecraft that NASA launched to monitor Jupiter. And this week it returned sights of Jupiter's Great Red Spot, which is one of the most famous sights in the solar system. And it's been continually observed since 1830, but it's believed to be at least 350 years old. And in addition to being one of the most famous sites, it's also one of the solar system's greatest mysteries, because nobody really knows how it started or why it persists.
And it's been there for hundreds of years, as long as we've looked at Jupiter, right?
Right, yeah. This kind of observation and is, scientists are hoping to learn more about what caused it and why it persists. And some of the observations they've found so far is that it's dome-shaped and it towers over the surrounding cloud systems pretty big.
Wow, that is spooky. We've got two spooky actions at a distance here today. Thank you for thank you very much, Nick, for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you, Ira. Have a nice weekend.
You too. Nick Stockton, science reporter at Wired. And now it's time for a new segment we're focusing in on local science news, what's happening around the country. It's called State of Science. And the state we're talking about today is Iowa. When you say Iowa, what? Most people think of corn. But farmers there also produce the most hogs of any other state. Did you know that? And a large number of turkeys. And farmers in Iowa and the Midwest are looking into a technique called multi-species grazing. Amy Mayer has talked to a few of these farmers. She's the Harvest Public Media reporter for Iowa Public Radio. She's based out of Ames, Iowa. She joins us to fill us in on that story. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks for having me, Ira.
This multi-grazing species idea looks like it's sort of a back-to-the-future idea.
That's right. I mean, it is something that was common many decades ago and certainly 100 years ago when most small farms had many kinds of livestock as well as row crops. But these days, most of our farms are more segregated. They either do just crops and one kind of animal like hogs or cows, or they just do row crops. Or out west, we have a lot of operations that are just beef cattle ranches.
Mm-hmm. So we have a clip from Will Harris, a farmer from Georgia, who was invited to Iowa to talk to farmers there about multi-species grazing. And this is what he talked about the benefits are.
Multi-species open pasture system has a higher level of animal welfare. I believe it is more regenerative for the land, and I think it benefits rural economies.
Amy, how does this benefit rural economies?
Well, in his case, when he was just a straight-up cattle rancher, he had three full-time employees. Mm-hmm. Now he raises five kinds of red meat and five kinds of poultry, and he employs 137 people. So there was serious job creation there. But also, he's got a lot of products that are now being sold locally. So those are dollars spent locally in nurturing a local business, and that's something that wasn't so much the case before. And here in the Midwest, the farmers are also thinking about local markets for the meat that they can produce and keeping all of that production and consumption in the region.
So he's had to become more of an entrepreneur and make money from a lot of different things that he's selling on the farm instead of just a monoculture.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. And is this kind of thing catching on with smaller farmers?
When Will Harris came to Iowa to speak on this topic. He was here for a couple days, and there were dozens of farmers from the region, Iowa, Minnesota, Nebraska, Illinois, who came to hear what he had to say. I would say there are a lot of farmers right now looking for creative ways to improve their environmental impact and diversify so they're not quite so dependent on one or two commodities, and then always with an eye toward how can they continue to make money.
You talked to Wendy Johnson from a small-scale farm in Charles City, Iowa. How is this helping her out?
What she's doing is raising some organic row crops and then also raising meat chickens, eggs, hogs for pork, and sheep. And with the hogs, she'll be able to turn them loose in between crops in her crop field so that their rooting behavior, as well as their obvious fertilization, can help nurture that land. And she's also found that when she has chickens following sheep on pasture land, that both the meat chickens and the sheep will eat the things that they prefer, and that helps nurture the pasture land, and it also helps the animals have a good diet.
Yeah, because the chickens will peck on the cow droppings or whatever, the sheep droppings, and spread out the fertilizer, and everybody's happy.
Exactly. Everyone participates. Everyone wins.
All right. Amy, thank you for taking time to be with us today. Good luck on covering the farm out there. Amy Mayer is a Harvest public media reporter for Iowa Public Radio based out of Ames. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to talk about renewable energy, and it's increasing in homes and appliances. They're getting smarter. You know what that means? We've got to upgrade the grid to handle all of this stuff. How do we do that? What are some of the innovative ways people are thinking of? We talk about ideas for smartening up the grid after the break. You can tweet us at SciFry, SCIFRI. Send us a tweet at SciFry if you'd like to contribute. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. If you build it, they will come. That famous line about a ballpark can now aptly refer to wind and solar energy. Renewable energy is booming all over the country. One day this spring, 40% of California's energy came from solar panels. And there are 53,000 wind turbines across the country. That represents about 84 gigawatts of potential energy, according to the American Wind Energy Association. But all of this newly produced energy needs to go somewhere, and that somewhere is the grid. Rick Perry, head of the Department of Energy, said his office would issue the results of a study about the reliability of the grid. That study was to be released last month. We are waiting for it to surface somewhere. So how can we modernize the grid to handle the renewable boom and the glut of gadgets that are getting smarter? That's what we're going to be talking about. If you'd like to join us, you can tweet us at SciFry, SCIFRI. We are not taking phone calls this hour. Stephen Collier is Director of Smart Grid Strategies at Millsoft Utility Solutions. He's based in Austin, Texas. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you, Ira. I'm glad to be here.
Let's talk about the grid. When we talk about modernizing the grid, does that mean we need to build a whole new infrastructure, or is it more about working what we have already and improving it?
It's really the latter. We do have an infrastructure that's aging and has become less reliable, and costs are going up, and so rates are going up, and so even if we didn't have wind and solar at the front steps waiting to get in, we have some issues with the grid. And when we first began to talk about the smart grid, the utilities were instrumenting customers with smarter meters, and commercial and industrial customers with the ability to control load so that we could make the grid more economical and more reliable. Then along comes solar and wind, primarily, originally, because it was green and renewable. But interestingly enough, in the last year or so, Michael Liebrich at Bloomberg New Energy Finance this year at their summit pointed out that for the first time in history, on a per kilowatt hour basis, the cost of energy from wind and solar is cheaper than any other source of energy on the grid. Now, that's just per kilowatt hour. It begs the question of what do you do when the sun's not shining or the wind's not blowing? But if we have wind and solar, it changes the grid in a fundamental way. Most of the grid for 100 years has been great big power plants shipping electricity into transmission lines, and that gets stepped down into distribution systems, which brings it to our houses and business. This wind and solar and battery storage and ultimately fuel cells and who knows what else is more distributed. We have about 20,000 electric generators in the country. We have tens of thousands of wind machines and solar arrays and a growing number of electric vehicles, so batteries wandering around all over the place. And that requires a different way of planning, monitoring, analyzing, and managing the electric grid.
Mm-hmm. And we also have a different kind of energy being made by these different devices. We're talking about a direct current grid now, aren't we?
Well, yes. The solar photovoltaic and batteries is direct current. Just like in the origin of our business back in 1882, Thomas Edison's first power plant, Pearl Street Station, was a direct current power plant. And so these devices create electricity and DC, and then we have to use some electronics to convert that to AC. Or in some cases, if you have a location, let's say like a server farm, one of the Google or Amazon Web Services farms, most of those appliances in there are direct current. You're having to take a wall wart or a rectifier and take the AC and change it to DC so that they can use it. And so we're beginning to see an emerging idea where you've got a solar photovoltaic array, some batteries, and you just use that direct current on site and don't use AC at all. And so you have a DC microgrid.
Hmm. I know that you work on the software side for better monitoring of the grid. How can we better monitor the grid? What are some of the projects that are out there, and why do we need to better monitor it?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, one of the things that happened when it became evident that the grid was kind of being pressed a bit on economics and reliability was equipping customers with what we call smart meters. And these smart meters do things besides just accumulate how many kilowatt hours you've used so that the utility can send you a bill. They can measure voltage. They can detect when the power is out and send a signal to the electric utility that the power is out. They can detect if there have been some blinks in the system. And so all of a sudden now the electric utility has more information about how their grid is performing and can do a better job of planning and managing that grid to achieve their goals of the least possible cost and the highest possible reliability and security.
Mm-hmm. Now we have a tweet from Robert who says, it's cheaper to use it where you make it. That's what, you know, you mentioned microgrids.
Right.
So
right. One of the issues that you have, and it's always been there, but if I generate electricity at a big power plant someplace far away from the load center, in order to get that electricity to the load center, I move it over long transmission lines and then distribution lines, as I described earlier, and lose anywhere from 10 to 15% of that energy and losses, basically heating those wires up. If I make it locally, I eliminate that 10 to 15% losses. And if the electricity is cheaper to make than putting in a coal plant or a nuclear plant or a gas plant, all of a sudden electricity becomes cheaper.
Yeah. Let me move on and bring another guest on, because the key to making wind and solar energy work is storage, having the electricity stored so it can be tapped when it's needed, when the sun isn't shining or the wind's not blowing. And, of course, we're talking batteries. Elon Musk realizes this. We just talked earlier about him building giant battery in Australia. He's building battery plants. And if we have more energy, why don't we just build a bigger, better battery? Well, that is easier said than done. And joining me now to talk about new battery tech and some of the challenges is Susan Babinek. She is Senior Commercial Advisor for RPE based out of Washington. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you so much. It's wonderful to be here today.
So everyone talks about building batteries, but there has not been a breakthrough yet in new battery design, has there?
Well, that depends on how you look at it. The first big battery that was invented was lead acid, and that was about 150 years ago. And then about 30 or 40 years ago, we had the lithium-ion battery, which was developed to power consumer electronics. And now we're in a whole new era where lithium-ion is being developed, so it's not just for a cell phone battery that lasts 3 hours, but it's for electric cars, and it can do many, many more things. So lithium-ion is undergoing a somewhat of a what you might call a renaissance, but at ARPA-E, we are also looking at brand new types of battery chemistries that can do more than just lithium-ion can today. So we are in the middle of a birth of a third generation of battery chemistry.
Yeah, because I've heard about batteries made out of glass, lithium air, lithium sulfur, all kinds of stuff going
right.
on. Is ARPA-E working on any of these new battery ideas?
We are working on all of those, and we're very excited about it. Yes, we are working on all of those.
Mm-hmm. And Steve, Walmart and these big companies are creating their own storage systems for themselves.
Well, yes, when they create their own storage system for themselves, I think that means that they are purchasing some of these new batteries that are being developed right now, and they're installing them in their factories and on their sites.
Steve, did you want to comment?
Yeah, there's another really interesting thing that batteries make possible, and that is, I mentioned earlier these smart meters and giving the utility the ability to manage that peak load and reduce the peak load so that they can be more reliable and maybe don't have to build a new generating plant. Batteries enable the customer to shape their load. And it may not be for reliability, it may be to reduce their electric bill. So it's an additional benefit of a battery, not just making it possible to use more of the electricity from that wind generator or that solar photovoltaic cell, but also to actually play the rate design and save money, or perhaps even sell their ability to control their load into the energy market.
And in fact, with all the cars that are battery operated and the homes that have batteries with their solar panels and smart devices coming on that store electricity or energy in another form, aren't we really sort of decentralizing the grid because these little devices are all acting as little pieces of the grid?
Absolutely. We have got a sort of a new phrase, a new term in the business that we call distributed energy resources. And it recognizes exactly that a lot of the generation, a lot of the energy management systems, the energy storage tends to be decentralized on the distribution side of the grid rather than centralized in large power stations.
Now, Susan, car makers are talking about moving more towards fully or partially electrified vehicles. Do you think this is going to be a game changer for batteries?
Oh, absolutely. Right. This electrified transportation is definitely happening. You can see it right now, and cars have all different levels of the amount of electrification, whether you go from a start-stop car, which has just a small amount of electrification, or a plug-in hybrid, or even one that's a full electric vehicle. This is going to happen. It's happening in transportation, and the types of batteries that you make actually depends on how you want to use them. But this is happening, the batteries are new, and it's all evolving in real time. One of the things that's really interesting about this, relating to the comments that were just made, is when you design a battery, there's a thing called the power-to-energy ratio. So if you have, if you have a kilowatt-hour of energy, do you want to get it all out of your battery in a short period of time or in a long period of time? And the way you do that makes a difference in the way you actually design your battery. And the types of batteries that you need for things like whether you're helping a transmission line be robust or whether you're storing energy from a photovoltaic to use overnight, the types of batteries that you design for those different uses are in fact actually different.
Mm-hmm.
And we're doing all of them right now.
All of them. That's a lot of research then.
Yep.
Ira, there's one other really interesting thing about the electrification of transportation, and there's also a move towards electrification of heating. For 100 years, the electric utility business benefited from a constantly growing consumption of energy. The demand for energy increased and increased. Over the last 2 or 3 years, the per capita usage of electricity in this country has actually declined. And so what utilities find is they're selling less electricity, and that makes it even more expensive because they've still got that power plant and those transmission lines to pay for. If we have a major electrification of transportation, all of a sudden we have a new market for electric utilities, and it can change the economics pretty profoundly.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International, talking about the electric grid and batteries. And Susan, what kind of different? How would the battery be different for a storage in a grid versus in my home?
Well, it depends on, well, even within the grid, there are many, many uses. But let's talk about just a couple of extremes. And well, actually, let's talk about your home. Let's say and you have a battery in your home because you want to store energy that comes from photovoltaic panels on your house, for example. What you do is you store it during the day, and then you want to have that available to be used over, let's say, anywhere from 5 to 7 hours. So that battery has to be able to provide energy for 7 hours, which is a very long time, but the amount of power it dishes out is really not that high, the power, that level that you have. Now, that's one case. If you go to a transmission line, there's many different ways you can use it, but one of them is to just keep the frequency where it needs to be and to keep the power constant. Mm. Now, in order to keep that power level adjusted so that it's at like 60 hertz, for example, you need many, many small bursts of power over millisecond or even second intervals. So you need a very high power event there. And the types of batteries that do that, that pulse the grid over very brief periods of time, those are very differently designed than the ones that are in your home that are going to provide a steady amount of energy over 5 or 7 hours.
Is RPE working on those batteries too?
Yes, we are. So we are working on those. We're working on both types of batteries. We have several different companies that are actually scaling up right now, by the way.
But RPE is slated to be zeroed out in the president's new budget. I mean, if its budget is cut, where is all your research going to go?
Well, we actually tend to, we are a science organization, so we tend to not address policy, okay? What we are seeing is that there really is a need to have this sort of research funded, because typically it's not really in the American innovation pipeline to do the high-risk sort of research that we do right now. But beyond that, I really shouldn't comment. Thank you.
No, I'm not going to press you to become political. I'm just saying all this great battery research that you're doing at RPE and suddenly it wants to be cut. You know, it's all about basic research, you're saying, which basic research usually is a government work and then taken over by industry. Steve, what do you believe about battery research?
Well, I think it's not just the United States of America that sees the benefit of batteries. One of the things we have going on in the world is 20% of the world's population uses 80% of the world's energy. And 80% of the world's population only uses 20% of the world's energy. And so you have China and India, throughout Asia, ultimately Africa. They don't use as much kilowatt hours per person as we do, and they want to. We use about 14,000 kilowatt hours per year per person in the United States. In China, it's one-tenth that. So they're building a grid, but they're not going to build a grid like ours. They are building fundamentally a more decentralized grid.
Yes.
They see the value of batteries, and I think that the whole world is going to be wanting better batteries for all these variety of applications that Susan talks about.
Mm-hmm. I don't want
to... Yeah, now that I can't comment on. I think that whatever happens in whatever short time frames that there are when it comes to politics is independent of the very fundamental question, which is, are batteries super important for, you know, enabling renewables to be brought forward and for these new generations of the grid.
And that's a great point to end on. Susan Babinick, Senior Commercial Advisor for RPE, based out of Washington. We're going to talk more about upgrading the grid and a little tiny grid in Brooklyn. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about the grid with Stephen Collier, who is Director of Smart Grid Strategies at Millsoft Utility Solutions, based in Austin, Texas, a state that has its own grid. We'll get into that maybe a little bit. The trend these days is to go local. And when you're talking about your food, your beer, why not your electric grid? I want to bring on a guest who is working on just this thing. The project is called Brooklyn Microgrid. Scott Kessler is the Director of Business Development at LO3 Energy, based out of Brooklyn, New York. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Can you explain what the Brooklyn Microgrid is?
Yeah, sure. So Brooklyn Microgrid is the idea that we can now allow peer-to-peer transactions of energy and energy attributes across the grid, and basically allow folks to start to buy energy from their neighbors. So if you're producing via solar panels, via wind, whatever energy generation resource you might have, you can now actually transact with your neighbor and make sure that the environmental and the economic impact of your energy purchasing stays in your community.
So give me an example of how that would work on a street in Brooklyn. How would that transaction happen?
So we're not actually using any new wires. So we're all living on the same electric distribution grid that we already have. So what we're really doing is a financial transaction of the electrons already going onto and coming off the grid. So it's really just a new form of settlements among people. But you can start with just the settlement and then turn that into physical actions. So not only can you start to buy and sell energy, all of a sudden I can actually sell the ability to turn on or off my devices. And you start to get to this idea of grid control through people's transactions.
So you could sort of get credit, so to speak, for turning off your electricity.
Exactly. Yes, you could start to sell that to your neighbor. The grid just wants to be balanced at the end of the day. So whether I'm turning on generation or turning off load, as we call it, as long as the grid stays balanced, it shouldn't really matter which one you're selling.
Mm-hmm. And so would this mostly be for people who have solar panels or wind energy on their roofs?
So this should work for any energy resource we have. It should be batteries that have stored power. It should be electric vehicles. I mean, all you need is really a meter that can count the energy and talk to other meters and form these transactions. So the color of the electrons isn't really important. We want to know what the type of resource is, because if you're buying local solar power, you want to make sure it's from a solar panel. But at the end of the day, this works for any type of electricity.
Mm-hmm. And how secure would it be from hacking my grid system, my little microgrid?
So actually, the system we use is called blockchain, and it's the same software behind things like Bitcoin. And it's thought to be the most secure system there is currently on the internet. They refer to it as military-grade security. Mm-hmm. And the beauty of it is anytime we want to add data or change data, you have to get what they call consensus from a majority of participants on the network. And you can't, if you look at a grid where you have hundreds or thousands of people participating on it, you'd have to have access to all of those points in order to change the data.
Stephen Collier, have you heard about projects like this?
Yes, absolutely. And I think there's a really simple example to illustrate what Scott is talking about. And one of my the cooperatives, rural electric cooperatives that I work with, has been experimenting with this. Let's suppose I have a rooftop solar array on my house, and I'm using that electricity. But my family and I are going to go to Europe for the summer. So I call my electric utility up, and I say, well, You've been giving me credit for the energy that I'm using by reducing my bill. I'm not going to have as much usage for about a month. But my brother-in-law across town, could he get credit for the energy that solar array is producing, because it's going to be producing more than I'm using at my house? And as Scott mentions, the physics really don't matter here. It's just the transaction. And there's absolutely no reason in the world that the utility couldn't say, oh, sure, we'll apply that to their account. Let us know when you get back. The wholesale power market has worked this way for 3 decades. And I absolutely agree with Scott that we'll be seeing this happen on the retail market sooner than anybody thinks.
Scott, have you gotten any pushback from the local utility?
We work actually pretty well with utilities. So in New York, we're going through this process called reforming the energy vision. And all the utilities are looking for their future business model. Like we were talking about before, we've seen electric demand actually decrease in parts of this country. And so utilities realize that their existing business model probably has to change. And so startups like us have a really big opportunity to demonstrate what does the utility of the future look like, what are the revenue streams that come from that, and what's the business model of a utility or an energy provider in that future. So that's really where we position ourselves.
So where do you stand in actually getting this working now? Is it up and running?
So we have about 60 meters installed across Brooklyn, all at buildings that are producing energy, usually solar panels, but a few different types of resources. And we have about 350 folks who have signed up to participate. We're working with the regulator right now to figure out what exactly do we look like. I mean, we're not a utility, we're not a generator, and we're not really an energy retailer. So how do we fit in, and how can we start to trade energy legally while still providing all the protections that folks on the electric grid are accustomed to?
You have to go through the paperwork.
Yes, indeed.
And when will we see results? Do you have any projection?
So we expect to be up and running in a few months, and then we'll have transactions going. There is really no end date planned for this. It should be a self-sustaining business that can continue on.
And can people do this in their own communities?
So we eventually want to get there. Right now, you would need our technology, and so we're still a young little startup figuring out how do we expand to every community that wants to work with us, but we're actually looking at demonstration projects all over the world. We actually just announced a partnership with Siemens where we're looking at incorporating our technology with existing grid infrastructure like their transformers and their substations, and also looking at physical microgrids where this has some really interesting applications as well.
Scott, different cities prioritize what's important to them in terms of energy. Can you give me an example of how you say someone in New York might think of their energy differently than, say, Des Moines or a smaller city?
Yeah. So what we want to do at the end of the day is really just give energy customers choice here. So you should be able to pick, do I want to buy local solar power? How much am I willing to spend on that? That's a question that depends on my values and my economics. And that's going to be different for folks in Brooklyn, for folks in Des Moines. And so what you really just need to do is put in place a system where you can express your preference. We have a mobile app for the customers in Brooklyn, of course, which is how we go about actually allowing them to express their preferences. So they can pick, what is the energy source that's right for me? Do you have an uncle that works in coal and you support it? Or are you a real big renewable energy local fanatic? Whatever's right for you.
So we have 2 million listeners. Some of them are going to want to be interested in this. Are you going to be overwhelmed with the requests of people as people find out about this?
I mean, I hope so. I mean, at the end of the day, you know, that's what a startup wants.
Steve, what do you think?
I think for the most part, retail electric consumers aren't thinking about this very much. There's a next tier of folks who are thinking about it. And I believe that the rules will change. It represents a pretty drastic change in the way we think about the utility business, which the utility thinks, well, I've generated my power. I'm going to deliver it over my lines through my meter to you, and you will pay for it. What Scott is describing is actually what is happening in many cases physically, because in many cases, the electricity that flows through my toaster didn't come from a generator operated by an electric utility. It may have come from a shorter electric distance from a generator owned by some other utility. Electricity flows according to the laws of physics, not according to who sends the bill. So I think we'll see this change. I think it will be coalitions of customers that cause this to occur, as opposed to because the average retail customer really doesn't understand this. The commercial and industrial customer does, and I think it'll be at that level that we begin to see some of this stuff really take off.
Quite interesting. I think we've just started a great discussion about the grid. Thank you both for taking time to be with us today. Thank you, Steve. Steve Collier is Director of Smart Grid Strategies at Millsoft Utility Solutions, based in Austin. Scott Kessler, Director of Business Development at LO3 Energy, based out of Brooklyn, New York. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for having me.
And now for some science to help you stay cool as we head into the dog days of summer. Did you know that not all ice is created equal? Nope, that stuff that comes out of your freezer, it's called hexagonal ice because its crystals form in a pattern shaped like a hexagon. Absolutely. It's the same form that almost all natural snow and ice take on Earth. But there's also something called cubic ice. Now, it's not the thing you pop into a glass before you pour your beverage. It's not an ice cube. Cubic ice is very special and can only be made by super cooling water to a very low temperature very quickly. It's sort of tricking the crystals into arranging themselves into a cube pattern. It's not an easy thing to do, but my next guest has come as close as any scientist has to creating perfectly cubed ice. Joining me now is Barbara Bislochel. She is professor of chemical and biomolecular engineering at Ohio State University. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks, Ira.
Well, when did we first learn that there was such a thing as cubic ice?
Well, there were these phenomena noted in the atmosphere of halos that had a very special distance from the sun, so they couldn't be explained by the presence of hexagonal ice. And so people did calculations to show that it's possible if the ice has a cubic crystal structure and the morphology, that the size of the crystal comes out reflecting that, or the shape of the crystal comes out reflecting that, then you could explain these halo phenomena. Mm-hmm.
And of course, once you discover it exists, like any geeky scientist, you have to make one for yourself. You have to make that cubic ice.
Yeah, you have to try. Mm-hmm. You have to try. And so what's been interesting is that for a long time, people figured out or thought they were making cubic ice. And in the last, I would say, 10 years, that whole idea of there being pure cubic ice was called into question. And so now what we talk about more is stacking disordered ice and try to characterize how much of that stacking disordered ice looks like cubic ice and how much does not.
So you can't make 100% cubic ice, but you can get how high?
Well, we got up to close to 80%.
Wow.
And yes, and so that there's still some question whether you can make pure cubic ice, but certainly in the lab, I would say 80% is about as good as you can go, especially if you're making it by freezing from supercooled liquid water.
All right, let's tell us the rest of the process. How do you make cubic ice?
So the way we make cubic ice is that we have this device called a supersonic nozzle, and what we do is we take water vapor and nitrogen, so we basically take moist air and we flow it across this specially shaped nozzle, and the gas expands and gets cold, and as it gets cold, the water vapor says, I don't want to be a water vapor molecule anymore, and it condenses to form very, very small liquid droplets. So those droplets are only about the millionth of the diameter of one of our droplets is about a million times smaller than the diameter of a rain droplet. Wow. And so since you have a really small droplet and you made it when it was really cold, then when it freezes, it's freezing at a much colder temperature than you could make a normal droplet freeze.
This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Ira Flatow talking with Barbara Wislosil. She is professor of chemical and biomolecular engineering at Ohio State, talking about making cubic ice. If I were to look at a piece of cubic ice, would I notice any difference in the way it looks from regular ice?
It would depend. So our droplets, our ice crystals are way too small to look at by eye. And so we have to use a technique called wide-angle X-ray scattering to probe the structure of the ice. And that's really the definitive way of telling what the crystal structure is that you have. So there are some electron micrographs that other people took that show if you condense water vapor onto a cold substance that under some conditions you can actually see little cubes, which suggests that the ice is largely cubic. But mostly we have to rely on indirect methods to tell us what the structure is that we've made.
Mm-hmm. So I'm not about to go up and order a bourbon on the rocks and get any cubic ice real soon.
No, it wouldn't survive. Cubic ice is very transient and fragile. So if you bring cubic ice up in temperature, bam, it goes over to hexagonal ice and you've just got your refrigerator ice again.
I hate it when that happens, don't you?
Yeah. Every day.
So, you know, what we always ask scientists and what the public always wants to know is, what is this good for?
What is this good for? Well, we want to understand how clouds work. And there's lots of calculations that show that if cubic ice exists in the atmosphere, it's going to exist in the very high clouds that are really cold. And then the way that those clouds interact and evolve can depend on the kind of structure of the ice that's there. So it might make bigger crystals, it might make fewer crystals, and then the way that interacts with sunlight is going to be affected by the properties of the cloud. I'm more of a fundamental scientist, and so I'm just interested in understanding the properties of water. And so water is like one of the most important, or if not the most important, molecule on this planet for life. And so people are trying to be able to understand and predict how water is going to behave. And they mostly understand it, but when you have to choose between something like cubic ice and hexagonal ice, which are pretty close in behavior, then it really provides a good way to test our understanding of the behavior of water, mm-hmm. and then gives us more confidence that we can predict what water is going to do under different circumstances.
Considering how cold it might be on some planets in our solar system out there, and how little vapor mm-hmm. pressure there might be, could we be finding more cubic ice on those planets?
Yeah, so the other place where cubic ice might matter is on asteroids and in interplanetary kind of situations, and right. on like the moons of other planets.
Fascinating. You know, we always think we know so much about water, but there's still so much to know, isn't there?
Oh, absolutely.
Barbara Wislauschel is professor of chemical and biomolecular engineering at Ohio State University. Thank you, Doctor.
Thank you so much, Aaron.
Time to be with us today. You're welcome. Craving, if you want more icy science in this hot summer weather, well, then you're going to love our newest science club. It's the Freeze Challenge. We want you to invent something frozen. Maybe it's totally new kind of ice cream or a toy to entertain your dog. You could use ice to create a new mode of transit or engineer a hat that keeps you cool. Be as creative and as silly as you want. Go to sciencefriday.com/scienceclub for some projects to get you started, like super cooling frozen fruit pops, creating instant ice. Share your submissions on Twitter and Instagram and on our website all month long with hashtag SciFryScyClub. That's about all the time we have for this hour. Charles Berquist is our director, our senior producer, Christopher Intagliata. Our producers are Alexa Lim, Christy Taylor, Katie Heiler. Our show is engineered today by Neil Rauch, and thanks also to Brian McCabe and the folks at NPR. If you'd like to write us, go to our website at sciencefriday.com, where we are tweeting and doing everything, and, you know, social communities all week. Every day is Science Friday on the web. Have a great weekend. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.